Well, it's been a year since y'all have invited me to be over. What I don't know what I did to you last time that you just got mad at me, but I'm glad to be back. I'm just kidding. I think Larry called me a couple times last year, but I was doing some things and didn't get to get over, but I have missed you guys. I have a soft spot in my heart for this congregation and sincerely and dearly love you guys and am glad that we are back together on this lovely, beautiful spring Sunday morning. The sun is shining and I think we're going to have a great time learning about God's Word. I guess I was in the fourth grade when I began to understand the importance of our topic for Bible class. When I was growing up, Scholastic Company would sell books at the schools. And I remember there was a group of books that my mom just did not want us to buy at all, but we just thought they were the neatest books ever, and we wanted to buy them. Mom didn't like them at all. They were cut-down books. And cut-down books were statements that you would say to another person to make them feel small, to make them feel little, to make you look bigger. And it was stuff like, you're so slow that if you got in a race with the turtle, he'd lap you twice before the race is over. Stuff like that. And I remember we'd read those, and my mom didn't like those at all. And some of them seemed harmless, kind of like that one. But then, you're so ugly that if you got a picture taken of you, the camera would scream and run off, and you know, stuff like that. And we just thought as fourth graders that those were the neatest little things, and that you were just so cool if you had the best cut downs. And I remember one of them was just something like, you're so ugly that if you got in a beauty contest with a dog, the dog would win first place and you wouldn't even place anywhere. You know, stuff like that. Well, I remember I was about in the fourth grade and we had a babysitter. And this babysitter was nice, had been babysitting us for years, had loved this babysitter. And I used one of those cut downs about somebody being so ugly that they look like a dog. And I said that to our babysitter. Now, I was in the fourth grade. Didn't think one thing about the comment. In fact, didn't think that it had any basis in reality. Didn't make the statement because I thought that our babysitter was ugly or pretty or anything. Just using the cut down that I had learned in one of the books. Well, I remember when my mom came home that my babysitter after that had obviously changed attitudes in some way. I didn't understand what was going on at all, but when my mom came home, she took me out to the porch and explained to me that our babysitter took that real personally, and that she had always in her life had a problem feeling like she was physically attractive, and that what I had said really hurt her feelings. And it dawned on me at that point that what you say really does matter. You see, I didn't think that there was anything a fourth grader could say that would hurt the feelings of a 24, a 25, a 26-year-old. I just didn't think that fourth graders had that kind of power. I didn't think it really mattered. I just thought that a 26-year-old be able to assess this situation and think, okay, no, that is coming from a fourth grader who doesn't have a clue what he's talking about, and that doesn't really affect me personally at all, and go on with that. But I learned that words are powerful. And that it doesn't matter if you're 2 or 3 or 4 or 40 or 60. What you say really matters. You see, we think it doesn't sometimes, and we often use our words like they're not important or they're not dangerous or they're not powerful, but that's simply not the case. Your words are powerful. You see that put in black and white for you in the book of James chapter 3. If you were to go there, you would hear James talking to his readers where he says, "Let not many of you become teachers, for we shall receive a stricter judgment." Then he says, for everybody stumbles in word. Whoever does not stumble in word is a perfect man. That word perfect means mature, complete, able to bridle his whole body. And then he starts giving you some pictures. He says, indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn them wherever we want. Look also at ships. Although they're so large and they're driven by swift winds, they're turned about by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. And then he gets down to about verse 5. He says, even so, the tongue is a little member that boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. The tongue is something that is powerful. Now, powerful things, generally speaking, are powerful for good or they're powerful for bad. A gun is something that's very powerful. Can you do some good things with a gun? If you were on the frontier and you were a settler on the frontier, could a gun keep you alive? In many instances, could be used for protection, could also be used for hunting and provide your family with the meat and food that you need to stay alive. Could a gun be used for good things? Absolutely, positively, guns can be very helpful. Can a gun be used for bad things? Can you kill people with guns? Could you use a gun in a way that would be harmful or detrimental to yourself and others? Sure. Now, what about explosives? Explosives, a good thing or a bad thing? They're amoral, aren't they? They're not good, they're not bad, they're just powerful. Can you use explosives in a way that, let's say there is a train or there is a road that needs to go through a certain mountain pass, and you can strategically place dynamite in certain places, move the rocks that are there, and send that train through that mountain pass in a good, positive way that will help people? Can you do that? Sure. Could you then strap some explosives on your body and walk into a marketplace and blow yourself up in an attempt to kill you and as many people as possible? And people do that too, don't they? Now, explosives are powerful. They're not good. They're not bad. They're just powerful. And so are words. And here's what you need to understand about words. Words are so very powerful that every single word you use is important. Every one. Now, you don't have to take my word for that. If you were to go to Matthew chapter 12 and you were to look in verses 47 and 48, I believe it is, Jesus Christ says, for every idle word men may speak, they'll give an account of it. For by your words, you will be justified. And by your words, you will be condemned. So, there you are. Your words, every word, is very powerful. Basically, God says on the day of judgment, you're going to come before God and he's going to assess every word that you've ever used. Now, how do we use our words in the way that God wants us to? You know, it's very simple. You probably saw the rule when you watched the movie Bambi. Won't ask for a show of hands, but if I were to ask for a show of hands and say how many of you have seen the movie Bambi, the Disney movie years ago, most of you probably have. Maybe you'll remember one of the very first scenes. Bambi is born. Well, if I were to ask you who the comic relief in the movie Bambi was, you would probably remember Little Thumper. Thumper, the little rabbit that has several brothers and sisters. Thumper and his family decide they're coming to see the prince of the forest who has just been born. Maybe you recall the scene. It is a beautiful spring day. The flowers have been blossoming. The tree leaves are green and the sun is shining. And little Bambi, just being born, is attempting to get up and walk. Well, because he has just been born and his muscles are untrained, he has a problem standing up. And Thumper and his family is there, and Thumper's watching him, and Bambi is trying to get up, but when he does, his legs are wobbly, and Thumper says, "Well, he's a bit wobbly, ain't he?" And Thumper's sister goes over to him and says, "Thumper, you know what Mom says." Thumper straightens up and he says, "Yes, I know. If you can't say something good, don't say anything at all." You know, it's just a little rule. If you can't say something good, don't say anything at all. But did you know that's God's rule? If you were to go to Ephesians chapter 4 and you were to look in verse 29, Thumper is summarizing for you a rule that the Holy Spirit through the Apostle Paul instructed every person in the world to follow. Verse 29 of Ephesians chapter 4 says, "Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers." If you can't say something good, don't say anything at all. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. Now, what in the world is necessary edification? What's that word edification mean? If I were to ask you, what is an edifice? That's a fancy word that we rarely ever use, but an edifice is a building. If you were to go into a city and you were to see a huge cathedral and someone said, "That's a very beautiful edifice." Well, what that is a building. Now, edification is a simple biblical word that means to build up, to edify. It's a word that means like you're building a brick wall or like you're building a building. You're building something up. What is the purpose of your communication? Don't say anything unless you are building someone up, that it may impart grace to the hearer. That word grace, unmerited favor, a gift. When you talk, let your words be a gift that build people up. That's what it's saying. I mean, if you can't say something good, don't say anything at all. Now, what if you kept a speech journal? Now, that would get pretty lengthy, pretty involved, but here's what I mean. What if for the last day, yesterday, you had every single one of your statements written down and you asked which of those imparted grace to the hearers and were necessary edifying words? What percentage of your conversation would meet that criterion? How much talking should you have left off that didn't meet that? Do you know what they say one of the most destructive things in a marriage is? One of the things that rips a marriage apart is constant criticism and speech that is not intended or designed to build another person up. You know that's true, don't you? You know it's true because you hate to be a victim of that. You know it's true because when you are unnecessarily criticized and words come your way that don't build up, you know how that feels, don't you? And yet somehow, even knowing how it feels, we still do it, don't we? You know, there in the book of James, he says that anybody that can control his tongue is a perfect man, is a complete man, is a mature man. Then he talks about how powerful the tongue is. He says it's a little member and it boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. He gives you three word pictures. The Bible is the best teaching document ever written, and it's because it puts things into word pictures that we understand. First word picture is a horse. You've got a 2,000-pound war horse, let's say. Maybe look something like a Clydesdale. We were down in Memphis watching the Grizzlies play the Warriors. I guess it was last weekend. It was a Saturday evening. It was a historic game. They were on par to tie the NBA record of 72 wins. And we were downtown and eating at one of the local steak joints. It was my son's 12th birthday. And we were there for his 12th birthday. We got him for Christmas. Me and my buddy got these tickets for Christmas for his 12-year-old son and my 12-year-old son. We were there in Memphis. And as you're downtown Memphis, you will see large horses pulling carriage-type, well, just carriage-like things. You've seen them, probably. And these horses will weigh somewhere around 1,500 to 2,000 pounds. Now, this one particular horse driver was turning her horse and cart carriage down a street, and one of the pedestrians, people walking across the street, looked up at the horse and was obviously kind of reticent to go across the road with the horse so close. And the lady who was driving the carriage looked at the pedestrian and said, "Don't worry, I'll not let this horse run over you." Now, a pretty simple statement. I mean, nobody else looks scared of the horse, but how in the world is a little 120-pound woman gonna hold back a 2,000-pound horse if the horse wants to run over somebody? Well, there's a little bit in the horse's mouth. That little bit weighs about 8 to 12 ounces maybe. It's a piece of metal that you put in a horse's mouth, and it's designed to be able to control the whole horse. And the horse may weigh 2,000 pounds, but that little bit weighs 8 ounces. Now, how do you get an 8-ounce bit to control a 2,000-pound horse? Well, that 8-ounce bit puts pressure on the perfect right places in that horse's mouth so that it becomes painful for that horse to fight against the bit. Now, here's what James is saying in James 3. Your tongue is like a bit. It's tiny compared to the rest of your body. It's not even 0.01% of the entire body weight that you have, but it's very powerful. And then he says, what about a ship? It's got a little rudder on the back. The rudder is less than 1% of the whole ship, but you can have one of those massive, humongous, all those big carnival cruise ships that are so large they can have 7,500 people on them. That's more people on a ship than was in the whole little town where I went to school at Santa Fe, Tennessee, back when I was in high school. Had about 5,000 people in that little township. You could fit every one of them on a Carnival cruise ship with space to spare. And there's a little rudder on the back, and it controls the entire ship. Oh, and then there's something else we really understand, don't we? Because if you're a parent at all, then you know that you don't want your kids playing with matches. Now, why in the world is that? Because a tiny spark. You don't even need a flame. Need a spark. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. I remember one time I was over with my two friends, John and Nikki, and we were probably in about the seventh grade. And you know, after the 4th of July, lots of times those fireworks go on sale for half price, and we would buy lots of those fireworks on sale for half price, and we'd store them up and then shoot them off the rest of the year. And I remember we had bought a smoke grenade. You know those little plastic grenades that have a little cylinder of smoke in them? And we just thought those things were the greatest thing. You light that thing, you throw it somewhere, big old humongous cloud of smoke. And we were walking down the road on, it was a country road where Nikki lived. His house was up on the hill. And we were coming down this country road. Not a whole lot of people came by that road. And we had lit one of those smoke bombs and thrown it what we thought was on the road. But if you have ever lit one of those smoke bombs, you know that at the end of it, there is a little flame that shoots out pretty steadily there for about a second or two. And we lit that smoke bomb, threw it across the road, and the big cloud of smoke came up. Boy, we liked it. And then we went back up to the barn where Nikki's barn was, and we were doing something in there, and we looked across the road. And the neighbor's field was on fire. Now, I'm not talking a plate-shaped size part of the field. I'm talking a field shape of size about as big as this stage up here was on fire, and it was spreading all over this. It was probably about a 40-acre field, I'm going to say, and about an acre of it looked like it had already been smoked, and we didn't know what in the world to do. And we ran down to that field, and Nikki, as I recall, was up on top of the road went kind of on a little hill, and then the field was down like a little bank, and the smoke bomb had rolled down and was burning all of that down there, and Nikki was up on the top of the road trying to wave somebody down. I think we had ripped our shirts off and were trying to beat the flames out with our shirt. Thankfully, Nikki was able to flag a person down. And come to find out, in our seventh grade minds, this was a whole lot bigger deal than it really was. This was a grass field. There was nothing else in it. And this guy pulled over and he said, why don't you get some pine limbs? And there was a pine tree or so around. And he went and cut us some pine limbs. And we beat that fire out with those pine limbs. But that whole fire, which we thought was huge, started from a tiny little flame. That's what James is saying, that your words are like a tiny little flame. Is fire a good thing? Oh, yeah. You know, everything metal you've got is made because we've been able to control fire. You know, any meat that you cook is cooked and edible because we've been able to control fire. And the thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of destruction out in California and people's homes and people's lives have been destroyed because somebody didn't control fire. I believe it was Tom Holland that said, that old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Whoever said that had no idea the truth of the matter about words. Because you and I both know that words are powerful, and they can be powerful for destruction or for building up. You know, I'm thinking about a person right now. This person, when she was in high school, her family was not well off financially whatsoever. And she was always a little self-conscious about what she was wearing. They didn't have the kind of money that other people had. I remember her explaining that when she was growing up, sometimes she would come home and her mother would be sitting out on the porch. And she would be sitting out on that porch because they had not paid their light bill and the electricity had been turned off. And that's why they were on the porch. And this particular lady at the time, she was 16, 17, and 18, she was very popular in school, but she was very poor. I remember her explaining that one time, somehow, she saw two of her fellow cheerleader friends passing a note. Well, she saw the note fall on the ground, and for some reason, she was able to pick it up, and she opened it and read it. And that note was talking about her. She was the subject of the note. And that note was explaining that these two cheerleaders didn't understand how this particular young lady got on the cheerleading squad because she dressed so shabbily that they didn't understand how she was popular at all and how anybody liked her, and they just didn't understand how in the world she had become a cheerleader. You think she remembered that? You think that made an impression on her? Do you think there were probably some physical, painful experiences that she forgot but that she remembered what was in that note more than 50, 60, 70, 80% of the things that she went through in high school. You think those words made a difference in her life? Sure they did. Sure they did. Because if you and I are honest, what we know is some of the most painful things we've ever experienced have nothing whatsoever to do with physical things. It's when someone betrayed us verbally or told us something about ourselves that was painful or told us something or said something that wasn't even true, but still we took personally. Words. They're powerful. Now, let me show you how they can be powerful for good. I believe the young man's name was Mark, and his teacher's name was Mary, as I recall the story. Mary said that she was teaching in the middle school, and they were doing math, and she said that this day you could just tell that the math wasn't going right. The kids just weren't concentrating. Something was just aggravating them. I think she said it was a hot day. It was close to the summer vacation. And it just wasn't getting done. The teaching wasn't. And so she said, all right, class, we're going to do something totally different. She said, today what we're going to do is I want you to get out a piece of paper and I want you to write down something nice about every one of the classmates in here today. Just want you to write a list of something nice about all of your classmates. And so, you know, Mark wrote about John. John, I think you're a good athlete, or something along those lines. He wrote about Mary. Mary, you are a very encouraging person. Something along those lines, stuff like that. And so she got all of those statements about the fellow class members, and she compiled them on a list for each student. She put their Mark's name and then would write all of the things that his fellow class members had said kindly and nicely about him. Didn't think anything else of it. Taught for several more decades. Didn't think a thing about that little exercise that she had done. She was coming back from a trip and her parents came to pick her up and they mentioned to her that Mark had been killed. It was a premature death. He was early, I think maybe 30s. And that the funeral was going to be at this time and that his parents wanted her to be there. And so she arranged to be there. And when she got there, the parents wanted to talk to her especially because they wanted to show her what was in Mark's wallet. And when she got there, they pulled her aside, explained to her how much Mark had appreciated her teaching so many years ago in the 7th, 8th grade or so. And they pulled out that original list of kind things that Mark's fellow students had said about him. And he had kept that list from the time he was in the seventh grade or so until he died on him almost every single day, looking back at it, reading over it. What was also interesting was that in this funeral gathering, there were several of Mark's fellow students, and as they began to talk about that list, one of the girls pulled hers out of her purse. Another one of the guys said, yes, I've got mine on my dresser at home and I read it on a regular basis. Just a few little nice things that a person would say that were so powerful that in a seventh grader's mind would change the way they view themselves. Now, do you think that your words are powerful? You think they're important? You think God cares what you say? We're just touching the tip of the iceberg of what we could discuss. Let me give you just a final instruction about these words. If you were to go to James chapter 3 and you were to look in verse 7, the text would say, every kind of beast, of bird, of reptile, of creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed, but no man can tame the tongue. It's an unruly evil full of deadly poison, for with it we bless God and with it we curse men. Out of the same mouth proceed blessings and cursings. My brethren, these things shouldn't be the case. Now, what does he mean when he says every kind of beast, a bird, a reptile, a creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed, but no man can tame the tongue? Does that mean it's a hopeless endeavor? Does that mean that there's no possible way for you to control your tongue and so we might as well not even discuss it? No, that's not what he's saying at all. Notice what he says. No man can tame the tongue. You can't tame your tongue, but you can control it. Those are two very different concepts between containing or training your tongue and controlling your tongue. You can't tame it, but you can control it. Let me show you what I mean by taming your tongue, and here's why you can't do it. To tame an elephant, if you have a baby elephant, early on you strap a chain around that baby elephant's leg. And then you strap that chain to something very, very sturdy, and that baby elephant tries to pull, and he tries to pull, and he tries to pull, and he realizes he can't break the chain, and it's hooked to something so sturdy, he realizes that he can't pull that out of the ground. And so he will try for maybe sometimes weeks to break that chain and pull it out of the ground, but it doesn't happen. And so the elephant learns that he can't get away when there's something on his ankle. You know, after you have tamed that elephant, you can put a little rope on that elephant's leg that elephant could break in 1 second. But he's been tamed. He doesn't try to break the rope because he doesn't think he can. When I was growing up, there was a little pet store right down in this shopping mall where we lived, and there was something called a clown knife fish. Now, I hadn't seen a clown knife fish since I have grown up. This guy was a specialty fish. He had a neat shape. He was about this big. His nose went down into a point. And here's what the pet store would let you do. The pet store would let you buy a goldfish for 25 cents. And then you could put that goldfish in that clown knife aquarium. And that clown knife fish would swim up to that goldfish. And he looked like he was going real slow. And that goldfish would get right by that clown knife fish's nose. And poof, that clown knife fish would hammer that goldfish so fast, you could almost not even see it happen. And all that was left was a puff of little gold scales. And you know how you can tame a clown knife fish so that it will never eat goldfish again? It's real easy. You put the goldfish in the aquarium, put the clown knife fish in there, but you put a glass barrier between them. Now, the clown knife fish swims up to the goldfish, thinks that he can eat the goldfish, wham, goes to try to eat the goldfish and rams his nose into the glass. He thinks, wow, that didn't feel good at all. So he backs up a little bit, waits for that fish to come a little closer, wham, hits his nose against that glass again. Thinks, this goldfish is tougher than I thought. Swims back a little bit, moves forward to the goldfish, wham! You know, after several attempts of that clown knife fish trying to smack that goldfish with his nose and running into the glass barrier, you know, you can take that glass barrier out and you can let that clown knife fish swim around with that goldfish and it will not try to eat that goldfish anymore because you've tamed it. It's not going to try to eat the goldfish anymore because it thinks that every time you try to eat a goldfish, your nose hurts. And so it just quits. You know what the Bible is saying when it says, no man can tame the tongue. What it's saying is there's never a point at which you have trained your tongue so well, excuse me, that you don't have to think about it anymore. Always, your whole life, you will have to think about what comes out of your mouth. Is it good? Does it build up? Does it give the listener a gift of grace? You know the rule. Doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter if you're the president of the United States of America. Doesn't matter if you're 7-year-old. The rule for your speech is very simple. If you can't say something good, just don't say anything at all. Well, I sure appreciate you. Appreciate you being here this morning. Appreciate getting to spend some more time with you on a beautiful, sunny spring day in 2016. You know, I was driving by, I think it was the Elk River, and I saw a man out there fishing. And I thought, you know, fishing is nice. I love to fish. But fishing doesn't hold any eternal spiritual value. I'll tell you what does, though. Coming to learn about God, learning about His Word, learning about how you can apply it to your life, and gathering to fellowship with fellow Christians and encourage them. You've made the right choice this morning, and I thank you for that and look forward to being with you in our worship hour. Appreciate it.